Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Lana, and I work for the UK's Defence Science and Technology Laboratory, which is a trading fund and an agency of the UK Ministry of Defence. My job is to look after the Strategy and Capability Programme, which is essentially the MOD High Level Operational Analysis Programme. That is, we address questions of policy, strategy, concepts, force structure, and balance of investment across capabilities. I'm going to speak about wargaming in DSTL, and in doing so, I feel something of a fraud because the other dozen or so DSTL people in the audience are, I'm sure, much more knowledgeable about wargaming than I am. I'm not really a wargamer, but I am a sponsor for wargaming that we do in DSTL and a supporter. I'm also hoping that they're going to help me with any difficult questions you throw at me later. I'm going to cover very briefly what DSTL is, where we've come from, what we do. I'll then turn to wargaming as a tool for defence analysis. And give you my view of how it has waxed and waned over time and what the future might hold. I'm not going to talk about the use of wargaming for training, although DSTL does have a research program in that, looking at the use of serious games, synthetic environments and the like. I'm going to focus on defence analysis. So very briefly then, DSTL is the main repository of MOD's in-house science and technology expertise. We have about 3,700 staff, about 100 serving military. Indeed, one of our former serving military is in the audience today. And about 500 operational analysts. That's a lot of analysts. To put that in context, that's just about the same number as the rest of the government put together. We do a lot of analysis. Mostly located at our three main sites, Portendown, Portsdown West, and Fort Halstead. We're a trading fund, which means that we recover our costs through customer-funded projects. There has to be a budget holder in order to fund our work. And our key role is to carry out sensitive science and technology work that is best done in government. We provide S&T advice on defence and security to MOD and a whole host of other government departments, but our main customer clearly is MOD. That includes scientists and analysts deployed overseas to direct and support operations. And indeed, the picture there, second picture down, is a sort of a bit of a key into Colin Marston's presentation and demos that we'll be doing later on the work we've done using our Possum game, supporting ISAF in Kabul. We don't do all of this work ourselves. We do draw on a wider supply base of industry and academia. And we also work very closely with our international partners. We formulate and deliver the MOD research programme, which is about £400 million. And overall, about 60% of that goes outside to industry and academia. I should be clear, though, that actually we do most operational analysis ourselves. About 90% of the operational analysis that comes to the DSTL is done in-house, but we are trying to move towards involving external suppliers rather more. We've recently let some significant contracts, and RCAT that Jeremy and Graham spoke about earlier is a small example of where we're outsourcing a little bit of work. If we look at the evolution of operational analysis within MOD, since World War II, this sort of shows that nearly all roads lead to DSTL via the various OR groups in headquarters and commands, via the Defence Operational Analysis Centre at West Byfleet, via the Defence Research Agency and the Centre of Defence Analysis. It's a little bit of a simplification, and there is someone here from one of our warfare centres who might slightly disagree that it's all in DSTL, but my point is that it's all kind of come together and coalesced a little bit more. I will come back to this slide a little later to talk about some of the war games we've used over time. The kind of questions that we get asked, here's an indication. Basically everything from the very top, looking at the current and potential future geopolitical context and considering how that might drive the potential size and shape and posture of our armed forces, to the very bottom, looking at small unit tactics, techniques and procedures, and taking in support to operations and peacetime management issues along the way. This is the only slide of my presentation that makes any attempt at humour, so you should make the most of it. But I think it also actually makes quite an important point that we forget at our peril. It's quite a lot of our customers are keen on good, cheap and fast all at the same time. I keep mentioning operational analysis, and I hope that resonates for people. But just in case it doesn't, our definition of that is the application of scientific methods to assist executive decision makers, bringing together objectives, options, assumptions, data and expert judgment through the use of models. And we see wargaming as an important part of the operational analysis toolset, alongside historical analysis of real operations, exercises, trials, warfighting experimentation, and a broad spectrum of computerized simulations, closed form simulations, and more abstract analytic methods. And I know that war games are simulations, and I also know that war games can be cheap and quick, cheaper and quicker than computer simulations. All this slide is really trying to do is just to get across that there is a spectrum of methods we employ. And indeed, we often try and use a blend of these methods, and I think we have a poster here today that tries to explain how we've done that in the context of the Army's Urban Warrior series of activities. So, turning to wargaming a little, some examples of past and present DSTL wargames. It's actually very hard to find photographs of what we've done in the past because we did tend to have an aversion to cameras. You couldn't take those onto secret defence establishments, but we found a few. I particularly like the photo of Lego Granby, which I think demonstrates that a sophisticated war game doesn't need to be supported by sophisticated technology. You can't quite see it there, but those are actually just Lego blocks, which had extra Lego blocks put on top in order to show whether they were suppressed or trittered or had special augmentation or what have you. But I'm going to talk a tiny bit more to the next slide. So building a little on what I showed you earlier about the analysis organisations over the years, there are a selection, and we struggle to make this a complete set, so it certainly isn't a selection of the kind of war games we've used over the years, and I'll just pick out a couple. The divisional war game that used to be run at Fort Holsted, mainly to examine equipment and force mix issues, was a closed game with a highly developed representation of indirect fire and ISTAR. It was typically gamed over 4 2-week periods each year, with each period covering 4 to 5 days of action, and with all four periods set in the same scenario. There are a significant number of military and civilian staff permanently assigned to the game, and those staff were augmented during game periods, so that the total number of staff came up to about 20 people in each of the red cell, the blue cell, and the high con, so 60 people or so overall. So it's fairly plain that that was a very labour-intensive game. It was also actually rather inflexible, had no representation of non-military organisations, and no simulation mode. It was finally closed in 1997, and eventually, some years later, replaced by WISE, the War Game Infrastructure and Simulation Environment, which is our current divisional level or so game, which was designed to be much cheaper and quicker to run, and to support both wargaming and simulation modes, and being able to switch between the two. Some of the other DSTL folk here can explain in great detail how WISE works. Khan, or the Close Action Environment, is a high-resolution close combat game and simulation. Again, it's a combination of the two that we initially developed in the early 90s and is still in use. Typically played by 4 to 8 players, able to represent individual weapon systems, platforms, complex terrain, sensors and weather, and down to a 10-meter physical resolution. Changing tack slightly, Possum, Peace Support Operations Model, which again you'll have an opportunity to hear rather more about, is a simulation-based war game that we've developed over the last 8 years or so, and is focused on the effects that military and political actions can have on the population. And again, there's opportunities to hear more about that. This slide, as I said, is by no means exhaustive of the games that we've had, but I think actually one thing that did come out looking at this when we were developing the pack was that actually, it's clear that we do an awful lot less wargaming now than we used to. And so we started getting to think about, well, why is that? And while I hesitate to talk about history in the presence of what is no doubt an audience of amateur and not so amateur historians, I'm going to delve into my version of modern history to try and talk to that. So dividing it up into three epochs, starting with the Cold War. And during this period, we saw enormous advances in military technology and tactics, but we had a fairly stable bipolar strategic situation. In terms of defence analysis, although this epoch included the beginning of the computer revolution, for most of the period, we didn't have sophisticated computer models, and I think actually, partly as a consequence of that, we did wargame a lot. And we mostly worked on optimising the mechanics of combat. So trying to summarise, we had a single scenario with a focus on a single type of war. I will claim that there were relatively few variables, although I suspect that no one that was doing it at the time would have seen it that way. But that might become clear as I go through. And I suggest that this may have been a golden age for wargaming, but I wasn't there, so I can't swear that it was. Moving on past the fall of the Berlin Wall and into the 90s, we enter a period of US ascendancy with a single superpower in the world. Gulf War One was an opportunity to exercise all of that high-tech weaponry that was developed during the Cold War and demonstrated very clearly how effective it could be. But in many ways, the 90s really were the decade of operations other than. In terms of defence analysis, advances in computing meant that we were able to develop complex combat simulations. And I think war games started to decline as a result. This was an era where we thought we could probably model everything, and we didn't need, perhaps, to get as many people involved. It's also, as a footnote, worth noting, this is the decade where the Defence Research Agency was born in the UK, and we started to think in terms of customers, budgets, and charging for our time. And I think that was also a bit of a death knell for wargaming, because it suddenly became very, very clear how expensive things like the divisional wargame were. However, we also started to see a more diverse range of scenarios and types of operation. And again, trying to summarise, the broader range of scenarios and types of operations, I would argue, introduced more variables. And while the physics of combat were very well understood and could be modelled, I think gaps were starting to emerge during this period in terms of our understanding of the human aspects of warfare, from the tactical through the strategic. Okay, moving past 9/11 and into the war on terror and ultimately into the Arab Spring, the world, I think, has become a very dangerous and unpredictable place. We can still prevail on the battlefield, but it becomes difficult to leave, and our adversaries increasingly are employing asymmetric approaches. For the UK, this is the era of MASD, military assistance to stabilisation and development, with as much attention on nation building as combat, and everything seems to have become rather hybrid. Hybrid threats, hybrid responses in a hybrid environment, or perhaps wicked if we were to go back to the previous speaker. In terms of defence analysis, our computer simulations actually have become rather unsuited to many of the questions we're being asked. And we actually start to see an explosion of novel and ad hoc methods. Everybody seems to be developing a quick spreadsheet of things. We also start to see a drive to understand influence, perceptions and behaviour, and this is the era when we develop POSSIP. So I think what I'm trying to paint is a picture of increasing complexity over the years. And in the face of all of that complexity, I think that wargaming is starting to show some signs of revival. I think it should be starting to show some signs of revival. So where next? Well, the world doesn't look like getting any safer or any less complex anytime soon. An awful lot of instability out there and all over the news at the moment. As technology proliferates, we'll be challenged in the air and space and cyberspace. We'll face anti-access area denial approaches, and the political and economic calculus is likely to shift against intervention. Certainly has in this country in the last couple of weeks, and we'll see whether it does in America in the next week. And I think the only additional point on there is that while conventional military technology will remain battle-winning, it's a bit more of a struggle to win the war. Other challenges for us to bear in mind, at least here in the UK, following on from the 2010 Strategic Defence and Security Review, we're still in the process of reforming and refocusing defence. We're trying to get towards a smaller, more professional armed forces and taking a hard-headed approach to what we can afford, which essentially means trying to do more, or at least a very similar amount with a bit less. We're also beginning the approach to the next SDSR in 2015. I think we'll formally kick it off sometime next year. And that will be an opportunity to further test and refine the role of defence and our ability to fulfil that role. And again, I think I see here a potential role in helping decision makers to navigate this process and immersing them into these complex worlds and these complex decisions. I don't necessarily yet see them crying out for it, although there's perhaps a little bit of appetite up here. So, in summary, I've gone quite quick. In summary, I think what I've tried to say to you is that the SDL is the main provider of operational analysis to MOD, although we're increasingly trying to use industry and academia. Wargaming is definitely one of the tools that we've used and that we've always used, but we do seem to be doing rather less of it now than we ever have. And I think partly that's the competition with models, but it does seem to have fallen out of favour over time, and I look forward to the session tomorrow on the pitfalls of wargaming or what have you, or the perceptions of wargaming. And consequently, our wargaming capability is somewhat fragile. There are pockets of expertise around possum and wise card. And I didn't talk about some of the air tactical war games that we have. We have things like Brawler and Joust, which are very much one-on-one or small, few-on-few air battles. But generally speaking, our war game capability has become somewhat fragile. But the future looks to be at least as complex as today. And there are lots of issues that require understanding, not calculation. It's as much about the politics and the economics as it is about the physics and the tactics. And consequently, I think we need to do more wargaming going forward. I think that we see in wargaming a proven, a structured, responsive, inclusive and relatively low-cost approach to looking at these messy problems. As a final slide, in preparing this presentation, it's become quite clear to me that the SDL doesn't really have a strategy for its wargaming capability and for developing that capability. And actually, I'm quite keen to start a debate within the lab and without the lab about what wargaming capability modern DSTL needs and about how we develop the people, the approaches, the facilities, what the blend of internal and external effort should be, and for this audience particularly, how connections might be able to help with that process. And as a program manager, you'd expect me to also want to know how much is that going to cost. And I will stop there. Thank you.